cultural difference itself is less often the focal point of discussion. Now, if you go beyond eco-criticism, I think there are some attempts in anthropological and sociological approaches to the global environmentalist movement that have included attempts to identify regionally different variants of environmentalist thought and culture and activism. And often the conceptual impulse behind these sorts of approaches is the attempt to go beyond the famous post-materialism hypothesis that was proposed by Nathan Rosenberg, the assumption that individuals and communities only become concerned about the deterioration of the natural environment once they've gotten to a certain level of affluence. So against that view, Sheila Jasanoff, for example, the science studies scholar at Harvard, has argued that the environmentalism of the industrialist world stands out by its global aspirations, while environmentalism in the developing world is characterized by its emphasis on the local. You sort of have a feeling that she can't have read a whole lot of American environmentalist literature of the last 40 years, because that would certainly persuade one otherwise. A little more persuasively, Ramachandra Guha and Juan Martinez Allier have distinguished between materialist environmentalisms that revolve around struggles for material subsistence and physical health, which they see instantiated above all, but not only, in the developing world, and then non-materialist environmentalisms that are primarily oriented toward aesthetic or other non-utilitarian functions of nature. And I've reproduced a schema from the first chapter of their 1997 book, Varieties of Environmentalism, on your handout. So you can see there, I mean, they're sort of, what they're interested in is the bottom left, that is materialist environmentalisms in poor countries. And the big achievement of their book was to make visible, as forms of environmentalism, movements, say, against the building of dams or against deforestation in India and Latin America, which are the two areas that these two scholars in particular focus on, and which in a first move they juxtapose with the non-materialist environmentalisms of the first world. So the sort of the interest in quality of life, in maintaining nature as beautiful, the sort of mostly leisure and aesthetically oriented environmentalism that you find in Europe and the U.S. But then they admit in a next step that, of course, there are also materialist forms of environmentalism in the U.S. and Europe. I mean, when people fight against toxic waste dumps in their neighborhoods, then that obviously is a materialist concern. That doesn't have anything to do with aesthetics. At the same time, they rely on theorists like Vandana Shiva, who has argued that there are certain kinds of environmentalism in the developing world which also have a sort of spiritual basis, that they're based in certain indigenous traditions or Eastern religious traditions, to argue for the sacredness of all life, in various versions. So that's how they come up with this sort of four-part schema. They really sort of start from the juxtaposition of the bottom left and the top right, and then fill it in. Now, these kinds of distinctions are obviously really useful at a general sociological level, and this was the first piece that really got us beyond this, post-materialism theory. But, of course, if you come from literary and cultural studies, what's striking about the schema is how incredibly general it is. Guha and Martinez Allier's approach provides no easy way, for example, to account for substantial differences in the cultural perception of various facets of environmentalist attitudes and thought. So, to give a few examples, very different perceptions of genetically modified foods between the United States and Western Europe. Deep wariness of nuclear technology that distinguishes German and Japanese culture from the traditional French perception of nuclear plants as icons of progress. The importance of animal rights in British culture and British environmentalism, which is really quite different from its continental European counterparts. Or representations of nature as rugged and wild in traditional Chinese culture, as opposed to representations of it as constrained, small-scale, and domesticated in Japanese culture. I mean, these are just a few fairly obvious examples. Now, that's not to imply that different kinds of environmentalism necessarily line up with the boundaries of national cultures. So I think that national cultures certainly do play an important role in shaping environmentalisms, as do different indigenous traditions. But what I am implying is that cultural study does require finer-grained distinctions than these very general ones that you see in the schema that I passed out to you. So what's needed, I think, is a more developed comparative eco-criticism that itself might be able to contribute substantially to the identification of different types of environmentalism by focusing precisely on the study of cultural practices, texts, and artifacts. And so that's sort of the general context in which I'd like to focus on the emergence of ecologically oriented poetry in the 1960s and 70s in two, well, really three countries, all of which have large, philosophically articulate, and politically very active environmental movements. So it's Germany, which of course at the time is still West Germany and East Germany, and the United States. And so, if very briefly, what I will argue is that the basic modes of approaching an endangered nature through poetry differ substantially between these two areas, not because of any striking differences in the kinds of ecological challenges that these two regions faced at the time, nor because of any fundamental divergences in the understanding of the natural world, but because of recent cultural histories that made certain kinds of lyrical engagement with nature available in one case and culturally unacceptable in the other. And from that comparative viewpoint, the questions that eco-poetry raises are not only those most often discussed in eco-critical analyses, not just Leonard Skigis, but John Elder's, Scott Bryson's, and so forth. That is, these questions about how humans experience, perceive, know, and manipulate the natural world, and how they translate that interface into linguistic and rhetorical form. The question is also, and I think to some extent more importantly, how such rhetorical forms, as well as the experience they translate, are shaped by, to some extent, quite contingent cultural and political histories. So that's sort of by way of general framework. Now let me give you, just to give you some idea of what the where German environmentalism comes from and what the background is for some of the poems that I want to look at with you. The trajectory of the German environmentalist movement is rather different from the American one. It starts at roughly the same point in time. The beginnings of environmentalism in both regions can be traced to the late 19th century, when you have the emergence of nature protection conservationist and proto-environmentalist associations in both countries. So you have, you know, John Muir's Sierra Club in the U.S., and both working class and bourgeois associations in Germany. But when you look at them comparatively, I mean, one difference is immediately striking. Whereas the Sierra Club was invested in protecting wild natural areas that were thought to have been untouched by humans, the German associations were usually called something like Bund für Natur und Denkmalschutz, that is, Association for the Protection of Nature and Historical Monuments. So nature was, from the beginning, not conceived of as apart from human activity, as it was for the most part in the U.S., but was thought together with human historical cultural legacies. Now, in the 1920s, a whole range of other movements and associations emerged that addressed different facets of the relation between humans and their environments, and you can actually speak of a sort of proto-counterculture in Germany in the 1920s. So you have a whole range of associations around nudist culture, the FKK, Freikörperkultur. You have an interest, very vigorous interest in vegetarianism, alternative nutrition, and health products that gave rise to the so-called Reformhäuser, and those still exist today, actually. They're sort of the precursors of your sort of whole foods on a smaller scale. So what we would call organic stores that sold specially prepared groceries, hygiene products, and herbal medication. Probably all of you know this brand Veleda, which dates from that period and still sells its products today. And then there were a lot of associations, such as the famous Wandervogel associated with hiking, that also were predicated on a certain understanding of humans and the natural environment. Now that sort of nascent counterculture was squashed during the Nazi years in ways that I'll explain in more detail later on, and didn't really reemerge until the 1960s in somewhat different form, when it was associated with the emergence of the contemporary environmentalist movement. Now, in Germany, as in the U.S., the impulse for the environmentalist movement was sort of a mix of ecological and pacifist impulses. So on one hand, the perception of environmental destruction and of industry and technology modernization in general gone haywire, but also vigorous and, in Germany, sometimes violent protests against the construction of nuclear plants, protest against the Vietnam War and the state.